Hello, and welcome to the Green Minds podcast.
Showcasing the science, stories, and solutions behind climate change.
Welcome to another episode of the IBE Green Minds podcast.
Today, I'm delighted to present our guest, Sean Kidney, CEO of the Climate Bonds Initiative. So firstly, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today, Sean.
Thanks for inviting me.
So maybe if we could start by just discussing the Climate Bonds Initiative, and maybe if you could describe a bit the work that you do.
Sure. Well, the Climate Bonds Initiative is the global NGO for climate bonds and green bonds. Our actual mission is to mobilize global capital for climate action. So bonds are a tactic, they're not the end game. We work with governments around the world, with regulators and central banks in particular, but with investors in make up a primary stakeholder base, that's institutional investors like insurance funds and pension funds. And then we work with commercial banks, all the big name commercial banks around the world, to try and grow this market and to get capital flowing in the right direction.
So you mentioned, so the main objective is just to mobilize that finance.
We've got to be seeing about $5 to $6 trillion a year into climate solutions on the mitigation and the adaptation side before we're making real progress. At the moment, we don't think we've cracked $1 trillion a year. Yeah. So getting that funding up. Now, that doesn't mean that it'll all come from private investors. Some of that will come from government simply issuing bonds to finance solutions. Some of those will be green bonds. So the labeled green bond market, and all that is, by the way, is an ordinary bond where the issuer is promising to use the proceeds for a relevant climate change investment. That's all it is. Nothing more complicated than that. It's a simple idea. We expect that to be a big chunk of the market, but our primary concern is that capital just flows. So if capital is flowing at the year, at the range of about $5+ trillion a year, then you know we've got a chance. Until capital starts flowing at that kind of level, actually we're a long way from having a chance. And by a chance, I mean a chance of avoiding utterly catastrophic climate change impacts. We're going to have climate change, right? We're in the middle of it now. We're experiencing it already. We can expect to see 2 degrees of Celsius warming with really major changes to the global climate, to weather patterns, to the way civilization works. That's baked in. And so we have to adapt that, which is why we need the adaptation agenda and start preparing, because it won't happen in a slow shift. It'll happen in big shocks to the system. And on the other side, though, we have to get mitigation down 50%, emissions down 50% in 10 years to avoid utterly catastrophic change, which is warming of 6 to 8 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. And, a good chance that humans can't even exist, at least an outside chance. And that's because the greenhouse gas level of the atmosphere under the catastrophic scenario, which is, by the way, the scenario we're heading directly towards at the moment. We're on the Titanic, it's heading for the iceberg, and we haven't actually managed to get the ship to turn yet, unfortunately. So that is a future of 1,000 ppm. Now, PPM parts per million of greenhouse gases is currently about 416. Right. In the middle of the 19th century, it was 250. So we're talking about four times the amount of greenhouse gases as were in the atmosphere in 1850. Humans have never existed on this planet with the emissions we have in the atmosphere today, let alone at the end of the century when we're looking to up to 1,000 ppm, more than double what we've got today. So we actually don't know whether we can survive. We've got no species experience of this. It's right. A new thing. So these are risks, right? Now, we're risk people. Nothing's certain, but the probability of there being a big problem rises exponentially from now on. And that's what we're trying to avert.
And you mentioned green bonds. I think they're a very interesting method to mobilize that finance. I actually had a question just around like the whole trend with thematic bonds. I think, there's been a lot of conversation around COVID recovery bonds as well. And there was one particular question which was around blue bonds. And I was wondering what your opinion was, if there should be a distinct category as like blue bonds, or if we should just all put that under green bonds. Is that something that you kind of have an opinion on?
Well, the answer is yes and no. All of these things are children of the green bond market. In the sense, the green bond market is the first thematic market we've had since the 1950s. when we saw a little smattering of highway bonds from the US and Italy. And it, again, simple concept, standard bond, proceeds going towards green. But it has been huge. It's a $1 trillion market now. Mm-hmm. So it's grown quite quickly and it spun off other options. The first sustainability bonds came from organizations that couldn't issue a green bond. They didn't have assets. So they mixed and matched. They put some, you know, a third social housing, two-thirds green assets, and they call it sustainable. It worked. At the end of the day, all we're doing is matching buyers and sellers here, right? And then we saw social bonds as an extension of that, which the first social bond was actually for cooperative housing. Whether someone in the US would consider that a social investment or not is a separate question. It was a German bond. So it's a culturally specific issue at that point. But they're all using the same principle, and blue's the same. When you're building a market, though, liquidity counts. So it's better to have one large market with subparts of it than to have different separate markets with each with illiquidity. Because if you're an illiquid market that is not big enough, you have an illiquidity premium. You pay 15 base points more than if you're in another market. It's as crude as that. Yeah. So in the broader enviro space, it's better for blue to be seen as a carve-out of green. Hey, call it blue, call it purple if you like, but let's attach it to the green market because it's already a large liquid market. Now, there's another argument as well, is that all of these are about stewardship of the planet in the context of climate change. So blue bonds is absolutely about stewardship of marine environments with the background of climate change. Biodiversity, people keep talking about biodiversity as something separate. It is not, because healthy ecosystems are critical for us if they're going to be able to survive the climate shocks we're going to experience this century, which is going to happen again. So, and biodiversity is an indicator of a healthy ecosystem. So supporting that is a climate resilience investment. Ditto of blue bonds, ensuring healthy oceans, that's about climate resilience. From my perspective, there's a link. So we need to be seeing all this as part of one broader market anyway. It's about how we approaching stewardship of our environment, of our natural environment and of our built environments in a way that is consistent in the context of the grandest environmental challenge we're facing, which is climate change, its associated species destruction that's going on now, and all the things that need to be done to fix it, from reducing pollution, which will allow you to improve the health of ecosystems, to circular economy that will reduce resource needs, which will mean less pollution and less carbon dioxide is created as we shift those resources around, and allow healthier ecosystems because we might be able to mine less, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is a broad systemic issue. So for us, it's all one market. It's all one liquidity, if you like. Yeah. It just has different subsections of it.
That makes sense. Would you say that also translates on for transition bonds as well? Would that be the same thing?
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, there's been a few talk about transition bonds being, look, if it's a slight improvement, they're trying, we should call that transition. It's not quite up to the mark of climate change. Are you kidding me? It's just sort of like, you know, well, I tried to stop the car accident. I didn't actually stop him, but I tried, right? That should count, right? No, it doesn't count. Unless you're achieving the Paris Agreement targets. It's not a real transition. It's a transition to nowhere. Certainly so, nowhere we want to be. The most dominant challenge, the overarching challenge, the thing that if we don't address, nothing else has a chance, is climate change. But on the road to addressing climate change, there are a lot of complex areas, a lot of high carbon areas that need transitions. You know, we need steel. We absolutely need steel for the green economy. We need aluminium. We need concrete. We need to make sure those industries transition to becoming low and zero carbon as quickly as we can. It's not going to happen in 2 years. It could happen in 10 years or 15 years. And so we need to look at what are the investments required to get there, the stepping stones across the river, if you like. Now, that's a real transition. Right. It's a transition to somewhere where we need to get to.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Often in the responsible investing, sustainable finance space, you know, people talk about the power of engagement, and it seems to be like a very strong theme. And I was wondering, you know, how does that take place for, you know, fixed income investing? Is that something which you see also having the same potential as in equity investing?
Sure. I mean, fixed income investors are still investors in companies. They're just investing in a different sort of instrument. And in fact, the bond market is way larger than the equities market. It's about 100 trillion versus about 65 trillion US in equities. You know, so there's room to throw your weight around in that area. Now, we do see people beginning to appreciate. Clearly, the idea of getting companies, pushing companies to issue green bonds is part of it. But, you know, when we surveyed companies earlier this year, 86 issuers around the world, and asked them why they're issuing green bonds, even when they're getting a price benefit, as they are in many cases, they're not doing that because of the price benefit. They're doing it because of the investor engagement. That's why they're doing it. They have recognized that their bond investors are looking for deeper engagement with companies that are seen as less risky because they are making the shift already. So they are less likely to be hit by policy changes or other changes associated with governments and countries responding to climate change going forward. They're less risky. Mm-hmm. And as a result, corporates who issue green bonds in hard currency markets, their share price goes up and stays up. It's a very direct correlation. So it's working in that sense. You know, it is, from the issuer's perspective, about engagement with the investors. And from the investor engagement, it's similar. You know, Swedish pension funds tell me, Sweden's the largest green bond market per capita. You know, it's a small population, but they've done a lot of green bonds there. That if someone issues a bond and it's not green and they haven't done one, many of the investors, the first question they ask is, why haven't you done a green bond? Is there something we need to know about you, about risk? And that's what we're getting to on this. Even on the passive investive side, you know, GPIF has told BlackRock and State Street that what it's looking for in its passive investments, not its active funds, is more engagement. They're not going to disengage. They're going to push instead. They are fiddling at the indices so that if you don't disclose things like carbon information and so on, then you might be frozen out of the index. But in the meantime, what they're going to do is engage with you on a corporate strategy level to push you to shift your assets and activities to a more sustainable fashion. So right. This is underway right now. It's absolutely central in the bond market.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. Do you think there's also potential for engaging with governments over like sovereign bonds? Is that something that you see there being potential for?
Absolutely. You know, yeah. I chaired a panel with the treasurers of this week in a conference, the treasurers of Germany, France, Netherlands, and the UK. And we discussed this exact thing. Actually, Sir Robert Steedman from the UK, who raised the idea of investors should be starting to grade the companies. Well, funnily enough, I've actually seen it. I mean, not so much sovereign, but Riksbank, the Swedish central bank, announced that it was divesting from all bonds and not buying any more bonds from a couple of Australian states on the basis that the climate policies were not in order. And I speak to many investors who are saying, give us robust information about the relative climate policies, different, because they see them as being more risky.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they're not taking action, then something's going to go wrong. I mean, it's not because of their contribution to climate change. It's because they think it means they're not preparing for climate change that's happening already and getting ahead of the policy and technology and industry changes that are associated with major governments acting on climate change. So they're just risky investments, and therefore they deprioritize them. It's underway now.
That's amazing. Do you think actually on the other way around, you know, there's been obviously with a lot of the bailouts now post COVID, do you foresee in the future maybe governments engaging?
Well, we certainly see in some places governments already pushing people to act, you know, through the means of the bond market. Possibly. I mean, we've already seen some movement by central bank treasuries to prioritize green bond investment. It's a kind of engagement, like the Riksbank in Sweden. But also central banks from Peru to Bangladesh have prioritized green bond investments. So there's a kind of variation there. The ECB has said it already has 20% of its QE portfolio is green, and it's looking to see how it can grow that. In fact, it's asked the European Commission to do more work on the taxonomy to make it easier for them to be able to use it, which is interesting. So you kind of see this beginning to happen in front of our eyes, but it's still got a long way to go before we see stronger government engagement on this particular feature. Of course, I'm not too fussed about it, because the key thing governments have to do is not push investors or push issuers. It's actually to create the regulatory planning, the energy rules to allow a shift to a low carbon and resilient economy.
Right.
You know, our energy system settings in most countries are still biased, often with direct subsidies, towards fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. Governments have to change this. You know, the bond market can't change that.
Yeah, that makes sense. And actually, on that point, you mentioned the EU taxonomy. I know you were very involved with that on the technical expert group. I was wondering, could you maybe just tell us a bit about, at this stage, just the climate change mitigation phase, which I think is most developed. Maybe just for the listeners, give a quick overview of what that involves.
What we developed in Europe, which is sort of modeled in the climate bonds taxonomy, it's been around for about 8 years now, is a catalogue, let's call it a procurement plan for Paris.
Right.
It's a shopping list. Mm-hmm. So it's a very clear shopping list of things we need to address the Paris Agreement. Some of those are straightforward green, like a solar plant. Some are enabling investments, like we need manufacturing of wind turbines, for example, or triple glazed windows. And the other ones are transition investments. So it maps out a transition pathway for the steel industry. If you've got this low level of emissions, you can qualify for green bonds, but it will get tougher in the future because at some point in the next 20 years, we've got to shift to zero net carbon steel, and that's all you'll be able to do to qualify. But we're going to give you a transition pathway. We've identified very clearly what the shopping list looks like, mapped it to industry categorization codes, the so-called NACE codes that Europe uses. And now, if you want to issue a green bond or get a green loan or just disclose to market what your sustainable investments are under the new European Union disclosure regulation that's in, which you're going to have to do, you have to reference the taxonomy. You don't get to make it up yourself or create your own methodology. This way, we can compare apples of apples for the first time, really, between different people's claims of being sustainable. And the taxonomy doesn't require you to care about climate change. It doesn't require you to do a carbon accounting necessarily. It just requires you to meet the published threshold or criteria for investments in transport and agriculture and different forms of manufacturing, et cetera, et cetera. So it's very simple. We've published it after 20 months in March. The report becomes regulation at the end of this year. In Europe, you will not be able to call something sustainable in the financial sector unless it matches the taxonomy. And there's a lot more work to be done with the taxonomy. You know, we've covered the first 80%, but we're going to be tackling shipping next, pollution control, circular economy issues, and so on.
Right.
It'll be an ongoing job.
Yeah. And at this stage, as far as I understand, so it's currently a green taxonomy, right? So it's classifying those activities which qualify as green. And there's also talk about having a brown taxonomy. Is that something which you would see as being a useful addition?
It's called a sustainable investments taxonomy, or taxonomy of sustainable finance, to be precise. We will be expanding it into other areas. At the moment, the primary focus is climate change mitigation and adaptation, the way it stands now. Yes, there is a commitment now by the Commission, thanks to an agreement with the European Parliament and the Member States in December, to develop a so-called brown taxonomy. I say so-called because it's become very unpopular. There's a movement in Black Lives Matter circles to have the word brown dropped for incipient racism reasons. And, you know, I'm very sympathetic to that argument. But nevertheless, in the official documentation, it's still called brown today. That will be done by the Commission in the coming year. So we'll see where that gets to. But the most urgent thing in our view is to promote investment in solutions.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of money around at the moment. You know, we have a lot of capital sitting around in places like German Bunds, which are negative interest rate. Mm-hmm. And 21% of European investment capital is in negative or zero interest rate bunds. So it's not a lot of way to get yield. That money needs to go somewhere. It needs to be told where to go. Mm-hmm. And that's actually more important than telling it where not to go, even though where not to go is still also very useful.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And you mentioned going forwards, that looking at other sectors beyond just mitigation. And one I'm personally very interested in would be biodiversity. Do you have any insights about that? Do you see how that could work in such a complex and like context-dependent sector?
Well, there isn't a sector called biodiversity you can invest in. And there aren't cash flows called biodiversity cash flows as a rule. So you've got to unpack it. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, the health and the resilience of our ecosystems is critical for our future this century. Biodiversity effectively is a symptom of that. If you have a biodiversity-rich environment and one where it's been building, then you've got a healthy ecosystem. If the biodiversity is collapsing, like bees collapsing in Germany over the last year, then that's a function of an unhealthy ecosystem.
Right.
So that's the key point to remember. So the question is, what are the things we can do which will lead to an increase or a maintenance of biodiversity, but an increase as a rule. Mm-hmm. And then how do they get funded, what do the activities mean on the ground, and then how do they get funded. It's very difficult to finance with commercial cash flow. There might be some areas. Mm-hmm. So it's likely to be government or subnational expenditures which are financed with a green bond. There are some examples where it can work. If you're looking at the payment for ecosystem services model, where let's say a mining company is allowed to mine in a catchment area, if it maintains the forest in the catchment area and the biodiversity, then that's kind of a roundabout way of getting it. And then they could issue green bonds against their mining operations because of the environmental obligations attached. So there are some options like that, but they're relatively rare in the sector because this is not biodiversity is not a sector associated with money, even though, of course, it underpins everything. Mm-hmm. So how you do it, it then becomes the question. It'll become environmental maintenance of land,
right.
Funding of national parks, funding mm-hmm. of new marine reserves, for example. A government could certainly issue a green bond for all of those things.
Yeah.
It might be introducing fauna and flora corridors within cities.
Mm-hmm.
That's a straightforward landscaping development cost for a city or other parties. You can use green bonds to finance that component. So right. There are things like that.
Mm-hmm. Do you foresee there being a day where companies are aiming to be, biodiversity neutral, even like positive, the same way today, there's a lot of corporate commitments on carbon emissions?
Actually, I think we already see it beginning to happen. Mm-hmm. There's only a few, but the odd company like Unilever that's now striving to do it now. You can critique them, but they're trying.
Yeah.
It's sort of underway. Not in all markets, of course, but in some markets. So I think we'll definitely see more of that.
Great. Okay, perfect. Well, the question that I always end my show on is, so I ask my guests to imagine that we're in 2049, 1 year away from having to be net zero. And so the question is, how do you think that the world will look?
It's a toss-up, I'm afraid. If you were a straight rationalist, you would look at the future and you would say, based on our progress over the last 30 years, we will have a world of extreme climate change. We'll probably have 4 meter sea level rises, which would have seen the wiping out of some of our larger cities like Miami and Shanghai and Jakarta. And hundreds of millions, if not a billion people will have had to move, which will have caused war. There will be the drastic reduction of water resources across great swathes of the world, and not just the arid zones, because rainfall patterns in places like Germany are going to change. They're going to become big floods. The snow will disappear in winter, so the moisture won't be held for slow release in the rivers. You'll get big rains, and then you'll get big floods, and then you'll get droughts in between. It'll drastically change the nature of agriculture and, of course, riverine areas in Europe, and large chunks of the planet will be uninhabitable as a result of wet bulb temperature becoming normality, which is where humans can no longer transpire. Those sorts of places are likely to be the southern USA, the Middle East, parts of northern India, etc. And we will have seen millions of people die as a result of those kinds of instances. We will have seen pandemics coming very regularly. We're going to see irregular pandemics anyway, but they'll be much more frequent on that. And we'll be on our way to losing a third to half the world's population this century. That's the current trajectory. And I say that because I don't think people quite understand this extraordinary risk we're taking by not acting quickly. It's a bit like walking on the edge of a cliff as a storm is coming in. We can fall very easily. And in fact, we're most likely to fall now because the winds that are coming through. We have 10 years. We have to reduce emissions 50% in 10 years. Mm-hmm. However, I'm hopeful. I'm a hopeful person. I do think we can do it. We have got some changes as a result of state action already. The price of renewables and solar continue to plummet thanks to Germany's feed-in tariff in the 2000s and China's massive procurement of renewables over the last 10 years, which has built a vast industry of low cost. But it's still only a small proportion of global energy. And for the last 5 years, we installed more air conditioning capacity on the planet than renewable energy capacity.
Oh.
So we're not actually getting ahead of the game yet. But you can see the start of it. We have the capital. We have more capital on the planet than ever before in the history of humankind. And most of it is in places where it's not earning enough money. So if we can create the investments, and we know what the solutions are, right? Massive clean energy, shift from planes to rail across Europe and the US, all of these things. We kind of know what they are. It's not complicated.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a massive program of restructuring our infrastructure and our urban areas and our agriculture over the next 20 years, with 10 years being the key.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 50% reduction in 10 years. And what do? We create a much nicer place to live in. We create cities that are greener because they have to be green, covered in trees everywhere, which reduces the ambient temperature 5 degrees, which you're going to need because it's going to get hotter anyway. We have cities that absorb water rather than put it out into big tunnels out of the sea, and stronger aquifers. We have agriculture, which is much more sustainable, which fixes carbon in the soil, which will actually give us a wider choice of food crops. We would have left the old-fashioned maize behind. Probably much more localized in the sense of urban farming. I don't mean countryside. I mean urban farming. Because of climate resilience and the kinds of shocks we've experienced this year in this pandemic, which is a kind of climate incident, we know we've got to have backup food production close by. Well, wholesale shift to hydroponics and urban farming will give us a minimal level of food locally, just a minimal level, to be able to ride out problems. Our cities are going to become much nicer because we've got to remodel them to be much more pedestrian and bicycle focused and much less cars. Cars are going to be relegated to hire cars, zip cars and different kinds of rent by the hour schemes. Hardly anyone, if anyone, will own a car in 2049. Now, whether they're automated or not is kind of irrelevant. The main thing is you won't own it. You'll rent by the hour. In the same way as you go into the city of Paris now and you can rent a Lime scooter.
Yeah.
Same principle. All cities will use the same kind of systems. We will be much more in cities. We're currently about 53% urban bound. By 2050, I think we'll be more like 80% of people living in cities. Now, that's actually good because that reduces our carbon footprint. That will allow us to rewild large stretches of the planet. You know, we need to convert about a quarter of the UK and chunks of virtually every country in the world into wilderness to allow our biodiversity to come back, to support species. Some of those species will need to be reintroduced, as we've already reintroduced the moose and beaver into Scotland. These are things we're going to do if we make the right decisions. And I'm reasonably confident that we're going to do it, but I'm going to say it's a very near thing. If you're not working on this now, just think about what you're doing with your life. Is there any point on working on anything else if there is no future for civilization, if we don't make this change? No future for your kids. But the opportunity is extraordinary. 30 years of economic boom as a result of this massive change. We will bring emerging countries up by their bootstraps to much healthier places to live by tackling pollution, by making their cities sustainable. And we will create a world that's actually nicer to live in to boot.
Yeah, I think you describe a world that's definitely worth working for. So thank you very much for that, Sean. Thank you again for taking the time to join us today.
Thanks for inviting me.